Welcome, everyone. It's Dr. Michael Morris of For God's Glory Ministries with you once again with our Bible study on CD. Well, as you probably already know, we're going back to the beginning on this session. We're doing something a little different. By popular demand, there was a request by many people to begin to understand better what led up to this New Testament that we've been studying. And so, in order to do that and do it in a timely fashion so that we can get back to our New Testament studies, I decided to do an overview of the whole Old Testament. Now, to set this up for you, this is the first CD of a 3-CD set, and you should have received all 3 CDs together. Now, there will be no quizzes on any of these 3 CDs. And on your first CD, you'll find the Pentateuch, the books of the Bible from Genesis to Deuteronomy. Your second CD will cover the historical books and the poetic books of the Bible, starting from Joshua to the Song of Solomon. And your third CD will cover all of the prophetic books. That would be Isaiah through Malachi. So what I'm going to be doing is attempting to give you a basic overview of the Old Testament. Now, the emphasis here is on basic. It would take too long and be too much of a distraction to our ongoing New Testament studies for us to go into a whole lot of depth, and for me to go into as much depth as I would really like to. So my goal, by the end of this overview, is that each of you will feel that you have a good sense for the history of man's journey on earth from a biblical point of view. I would hope that the Old Testament will no longer be mysterious, and when you read it, you'll have a healthier perspective and a useful context to go by. Now, as you'll see, after a certain point in the book of Genesis, the emphasis of the Bible is on the events involving the Hebrew people and God's relationship with that people. Now, in this overview, I hope to inform you on how each book of the Old Testament fits in the story to be told. I will also try to point out the more prominent people and events as we go along. Now, in this process, there will definitely, of course, be things that are left out. That's simply what you expect in such a basic overview. Now, you may have noticed that I've left out the New Testament. Well, even though I considered doing a review of the New Testament also, we kind of do that as we go along anyway, putting things into context. And I also feel that since we are currently covering the New Testament in great detail, it's just not necessary to give an overview at this time. Well, let's go ahead and get started with the book of Genesis. I know some of you may be in your cars as you read this, although, as usual, I really hope that you have your Bibles out. And if you don't, I hope that you read the Bible that we're going to be covering ahead of time. Now, I do understand that we're going to be covering every single book of the Old Testament, and you can't read the whole Old Testament. But again, I think it's just helpful if you try to read at least a little bit of what you're going to be listening to on the CD, or at least afterwards. Go take a look at it for yourself. So, the book of Genesis, this book is the first book of 5 books of the Bible written by Moses. These make up the first 5 books in our Bible, and they are collectively called the Pentateuch, or the Torah. The Pentateuch, of course, is Greek, and the penta means 5. Now, Moses lived from 1526 B.C. to 1406 B.C. And I'll just tell you right now, there's going to be a lot of these dates, not a whole lot, but a fair number of them. And just keep in mind, remember that when we're going to BC towards the birth of Christ, the numbers get smaller. And then after that, in AD times, the numbers get larger, okay? So now, Moses lived from 1526 to 1406 BC. And he did most of his biblical writings from 1450 to 1410 BC. Now, this is when he was 76 years old to 116 years old. But Moses died 4 years after this, when he was 120 years old. Now, let me tell you why that's significant. Moses was not perfect, but Moses is considered by many to be the greatest prophet that ever lived. And obviously God thought something very special of him. Even though he did not set foot in the promised land, he let him live to 120 years of age. And why this is important is that this happened to be the maximum allowable age for man, which was decreed by God in Genesis chapter 6, verse 3. Now, this was not always the case, as before this, man lived much longer, and actually Methuselah was the oldest man that ever lived, and he lived 969 years. Now, if you take a look at that verse, you'll see, if you look at the verse before it, you'll see that this decree came once the sons of God began taking women or wives of the sons of men. Now remember, the sons of God were the relatively good people that came from Abel. And remember, Abel was killed by Cain, and then Abel was replaced by Seth. And that whole lineage which led to Enoch and then to Noah. So these were the sons of God. And then the sons of men were the descendants of Cain, the murderer. And so the sons of God began to see the beauty in the sons of men, and they begin to mix with them and realize the longer you live, the longer your fertile period, the more children you can have. And so God was limiting the damage without completely destroying man. So anyway, God put this limit, and Moses was allowed to make it to that limit. So now, as we begin to look at the book of Genesis, you'll notice that I'll be a little more detailed in these first few chapters than anywhere else in the Old Testament overview. Now, this is because the beginning sets the stage for the rest of man's time on earth. It also sets the tone of God's relationship with man. So now in chapter 1 of Genesis, we have God's creation of the earth, its universe, and the plants and animals on the earth and in the sea. And then as you look at verse 26, we see that God made man in his own image and gave him dominion over the earth and all the things on the earth. Now this ended God's 6 days of creation. Now, elsewhere in the Bible, it says that to God, a day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as a day. And this helps us to understand that it took longer than 6 of our calendar days to produce God's creation. Now, that does begin to kind of correlate what man's sense of the universe and its timing is compared to biblical version, but that is, I won't take that as an attempt to try to justify man's way of looking at things, except to say that clearly there's much more time involved here than just 6 days, and it does explain some of what man has begun to understand about God's creation of the universe. Not that they give God credit. As far as God's time versus our time issue, the references that you can check for on that are 2 Peter chapter 3 verse 8, which is what I essentially just paraphrased. And then also check out the book of Psalms 90, verse 4. And you'll see where I'm coming from there. So then we take a look at Genesis chapter 2, where we see that God rested the seventh day, and he sanctified that day, and this is the origin of the idea of the Sabbath day. So up to this point, we've got creation, and we've got God's day of rest. And now if you take a look in verse 4 of chapter 2, through the rest of the whole of chapter 2, we have essentially a more detailed accounting of God's creation of things on earth, focusing on those things pertaining to man. So in chapter 1, we have creation. In chapter 2, the first few verses, we have essentially God's seventh day of rest. Now remember, these chapters, these were not written in chapters, so it's somewhat artificial, done for convenience for reading. And so we see that the seventh day of creation is still in, is into chapter 2, and the first six were found in chapter 1. And then after verse 4, you essentially see a more detailed accounting of what you read about in chapter 1, but focusing on those verses associated with and pertaining to man. Now, this is a detailed description of where the Garden of Eden was located as we take a look at these verses. And there's essentially an area from northeast Africa to the Persian Gulf that seems to encompass this location of the Garden of Eden. Now, as you look further down in verse 9, we see that God made trees that were pleasant to look at and also good for food. Now, this is the same description of these trees that was given by Eve as she ate the forbidden fruit. But we'll get to that a little bit later. But now, among those trees that God created was the tree of life and also the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, Adam and Eve were made initially innocent. Of course, depending upon God and communing with God in perfect harmony. And we had this wonderful garden, which they could partake of any time they wanted to. But of course, you had these two trees, one the tree of life and one the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And so next, we look at verses 15 through 17 of chapter 2, because then we start to understand, you know, what happened after this beautiful beginning. And these verses are some of the most critical scripture that you will read anywhere in the Bible. Because God put man in the garden to go cultivate it and to enjoy it. He could have anything that he wanted to eat there, except for the fruit on the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, this is not a critical point, but I'm going to concede the fact that, no, it does not say that it was an apple tree. You hear some stories sometimes and they talk about she ate an apple and some people quibble away. She, you know, never says she ate an apple. Okay, fine. It was a fruit tree. Okay, folks. And, we'll just leave it at that. The bottom line is that it was indeed forbidden. Now, God says in verse 17, that in the day that man ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that he would surely die. And then the rest of the chapter shows Adam, which was God's first creation, shows him naming all of the animals as God had told him to do. And the last several verses of chapter 2 are devoted to describing how God made woman and instituted the bond of man and woman. And we're going to get, that's the end of chapter 2, and we'll pick up chapter 3 on your next track. Okay, now on to chapter 3. Now this next chapter is as critical, if not more critical than chapter 2. But this whole section of scripture, I want to make this point, are very critical to get a good picture of, because essentially all of the rest of the Bible goes back to this. Every time you see man straying from God, God trying to call him back, and then unfortunately man having to suffer the results of his sin, and then ultimately God paving the way for his forgiveness of those sins, and mending that relationship again, is essentially in a capsule the story of the Bible. And all of those things, those snares that would get in man's way from here on out, of course, were clothed in pride, and of course, Satan's snares. And so keep that in mind as we get this snapshot of the essence of the whole Bible. It's about a relationship. It's about a relationship of a creator to his creation, and an enemy that wants to hurt him and therefore does so through the one that he loves. So keep that in mind as we go forward. So in chapter 3, it depicts the disobedience of man or mankind to God's instructions not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now the serpent, a representation of the devil, manipulated Eve into eating the forbidden fruit. Now this was the original sin. Every other sin that you see in the Bible, every other wayward move of man that you see in the Bible, comes right back to this. This was just the original sin. Now, because of it, man was cursed to experience spiritual death and physical separation from God. They were thrown out of the garden, and the woman, Eve, blamed the serpent, and the man, Adam, blamed Eve. But of course, they were all responsible, Adam, Eve, and Satan, for their own actions. Now, Satan, or the devil, though unlike Adam and Eve, had nothing to lose. He was out to destroy the relationship that God had with his beloved creatures. And but for God's redeeming grace and saving power, this would have been a permanent death blow to that relationship. Now, as you study the Bible, you can essentially separate everything that we've learned up to and including chapter 3 from everything else. Because at this point, as you look at chapter 4, creation is complete. Man has sinned and fallen, and he is now cursed in many ways. And so he is now cursed with the burden of his sinful state, his loss of innocence. And the man must now sweat to produce his food, unlike before. And the woman has now must endure much pain in childbirth. This is a consequence of their sin. Now, this chapter is the beginning, essentially, of the rest of the whole story of the Bible. And Adam and Eve had two sons. Their names were Cain and Abel. And Cain, who murdered his brother out of jealousy, I won't go through the whole story, but he turns out to manifest the worst of man's sinful state, whereas his brother Abel largely represent what was pleasing in God's eyesight. This despite the mistake of his parents. Now, once Abel was killed, Seth was born as Abel's replacement in God's eyes, and that's what Seth means, a replacement. And in Seth's lineage were men who pleased God, just as Abel and Seth did. We have people such as Enoch who pleased God and therefore he never saw death. But the majority of people, because of their sinful nature and desires, ignored God and rebelled against him. And if you look further to the end of chapter 5, you'll see that Noah and his three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, are mentioned for the first time. But at this point, God had grown tired of man's sinful acts and attitude and desired to punish him for his tireless sinning against him. And he affirmed that one man on earth was worth saving at this point, and that was Noah. And so Noah and his family were instructed to build a boat, usually called an ark. And an ark just means a container. And in this case, the container would carry very precious cargo. The seed, which would be the beginning of the rest of all mankind. So, again, within this ark was the hope of all living things upon earth. And Noah was instructed in a very specific way on how to construct this craft. And since it had never yet rained, it seemed silly to everybody that he was building this big object. But Noah was, in spite of all of the names he was called and the way that people thought he was crazy, he was obedient. And finally, indeed, God did cause it to rain for 40 days and 40 nights, thus creating the great flood that we've all heard of. And as a result of that, all living things upon the earth were killed except Noah, his wife, his three sons, and their wives. And once the rain stopped, the waters gradually receded, and the ark settled on Mount Ararat. Now, this is an area that is roughly corresponds to eastern Turkey, northern Iran, and Russian Armenia, if you want to look on your map and get a sense of that. And there's been a great deal of evidence since then to confirm that. And so from there, the world is repopulated by Noah's sons and his daughters-in-law. And so God also at this point made a covenant with Noah never to destroy the earth by flood again. And the rainbow is the sign of this covenant between Noah and God. And so man began to repopulate the earth, the three sons populating the three essential areas, you might say, of the earth at the time, the known world at the time, that being essentially the Middle East, Europe, and Africa. And so as you read on and you see in chapter 11, we see that man in his prideful unity endeavored to build a city and a tower tall enough to reach heaven as a testament to himself, that is, being man. Now, this was built in a city that ultimately was called Babel, and this you would find actually in modern day Iraq. And the reason that the way that this city came to have its name was that God foiled their plan by confounding their language so that they couldn't communicate with each other and thus could not complete the project. You may recall that we mentioned this back in Acts chapter 2 when God did rather the reverse of this, which allowed people to speak languages that they didn't normally speak and actually have it be a unifying and a helpful thing. Just the opposite of this situation here where God had to hinder man from ultimately destroying himself in his sinful acts. And so that's why that city came to have its name, and it is also the essential origins of the capital of what became the world power of Babylon. Now, let's look at chapter 12 of Genesis. Chapter 12 of Genesis is the beginning of the lineage of modern-day religious structure in the world. Here, God makes his covenant with Abram, the only man that God felt he could entrust his desires to make himself a people. God desired to have a people who would relate to him as he originally designed it, or as close as they could come to it, and he entrusted this in Abram. He also wanted to have a people that could be an example to the rest of the world and draw them, hopefully, unto himself in their rightful place. Now, Abram and his wife Sarah were childless because Sarah was barren. But God promised them a son despite their situation. Now, as time went on, they had not born themselves a child, and they decided that they were getting old, and this miracle of God was not going to come to pass. And so they decided, or Sarah decided, and Abram went along with it, they decided to help God out. And they decided to have Abram to have a baby with Hagar, which is Sarah's handmaiden or concubine. Now the product of this couple was, his name was Ishmael. And Abraham loved Ishmael as he was indeed his only son. But unfortunately, as time went on, the two women could not coexist. There was a great deal of resentment and jealousy. At this time in ancient history, you were honored and you were considered blessed and special if you were fertile. And if you were infertile, it was the most humiliating thing that a woman could have to endure. There was a great deal of, I'm sure, Hagar threw this up in Sarah's face, and it was just too difficult for Sarah to see that this woman had borne for her husband the greatest thing in his life. And so Hagar and her son Ishmael were expelled from the family and sent away. And Ishmael gave rise to the Arab peoples of the world. And even though these were not the people of God's promise, God did promise that he would make Ishmael into a great nation. But the important thing to remember here is that Ishmael is the progenitor. He is the seed of what has become the Arab peoples. And so later, the infertile couple, advanced in age as they were, conceived a child, just as God had promised. You know, God may not come when you want him, but he is always right on time. And this son's name was Isaac. Now, this was the beginning of the Hebrew lineage. Now, there are some other things that happened where God asked Abram to sacrifice Isaac, that is, kill him, and giving him unto the Lord. Abram was tested this way, and he was willing to take away this one specially, miraculously begotten son on God's instruction. Well, God stopped him before he did that and provided his own sacrifice in the form of a ram in the bush. But God knew, beyond a shadow of a doubt at this point, that he could trust Abram with this special thing. And so Isaac and his wife, Rebekah, had twin sons. They were Jacob and Esau. Now, Esau was born first, so he was technically the eldest or the oldest. And he therefore had the birthright as the oldest. There were some special blessings to come to him as the oldest. But as you read it in the Bible, you will see that through laziness and mostly through trickery on Jacob's part, he was able to sell or swindle away his birthright from his oldest brother, Esau. Now, Jacob's name means deceitful. So he definitely fit the bill. But it was actually according to God's will that Jacob was indeed the one that the promise was to be due to. It just so happened that Esau was born first. And so the promise was to come through Jacob, and this is why the Hebrew God is called the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They were the original patriarchs of the Hebrew people. And later on, Jacob's name was changed by God to Israel. Therefore, he had shed his original characteristics and had become one as unto God. And because his name was Israel, that is Jacob, the grandson of Abram, this is why God's people were called the children of Israel. That's not just terminology, it's literally they were the children of Israel. Jacob's descendants made up the 12 tribes that were all named after his sons and two grandsons, which came by his son Joseph. And so when you hear the term the children of Israel, that's rather literal, even though it ended up being you know, a mass of people because of their multiplication, especially in Egypt. But it's actually literal. That's why they are called the children of Israel. Now, back, I just want to give you just a little more detail. That name Israel, that was fairly significant. Again, that it signaled a change in Jacob's life. That name means God strives, or God rules, or God heals. And this name was given to Jacob, as I mentioned before, after he wrestled with the divine messenger, an angel, in Genesis chapter 32. And indeed, afterwards, Jacob was a changed person. He had a limp because of his thigh being damaged in the wrestling, but he also had new food regulations, and he had a new experience of God that influenced the way he lived. And so next, as you read through Genesis, you begin to see a focus on Jacob's children, and particularly his sons. And he had this one young son named Joseph. He would anger his older brothers because of visions that he would have. And his father made him a special coat, and he flaunted that. And he was just not very shy to speak his mind and to think highly of his future. And so he had these visions which described himself in a superior position and his brothers bowing down to him. Now, he didn't create this vision, but he definitely was not shy in sharing this vision. And so, basically, he became really a pest to his brothers. And so his brothers one day plotted to kill him and to lie and say that he had been hurt by a lion. Well, ultimately, they didn't kill him, but they did pull off most of this prank, and they threw him into a pit, and he was actually sold into slavery and taken to Egypt. Now, ultimately, though, there's a lot I'm leaving out, but he ultimately gained the trust and the admiration of the Pharaoh, the head of all of Egypt, and he became second in command only to Pharaoh. And so he devised an ingenious plan to provide food in the time of famine, as God had shown him would occur. And all of the surrounding areas would come to Egypt for food, and that included Joseph's brothers. And Joseph's father also finally came. And so when Joseph finally died, he made the children of Israel promise to bury his bones in the land that God had promised Abraham, his great grandfather, that he would give him, and he did not want his bones to be laid to rest in Egypt. And with that, the book of Genesis ends. Now, before we go on to the book of Exodus, I'd like to mention one little thing, because there is probably one of the most well-known and oft-referenced passages from this story of Joseph is found in verse 20 of this final chapter. And this is where Joseph tells his brothers that what they did to him, they meant for evil, but God meant it for good. And so you often times see people referencing that as they say that the devil meant a certain difficult situation in their life for evil, but God meant it for good. They meant it for an ultimate blessing, even though the beginnings may have seemed negative or difficult. And so that's it for the book of Genesis, folks, and I hope that was helpful to you. And we're going to get started looking at the book of Exodus on your next track. Well, on to the book of Exodus. The book of Exodus is named appropriately because of the exodus of the Hebrew people out of the land of Egypt and ultimately wandering in the wilderness or desert prior to entering into the promised land. So the book of Exodus begins with the children of Israel enslaved by the Egyptians under a tyrannical Pharaoh that did not have a favorable relationship with the Hebrews, such as that that occurred with Joseph. Now, this Pharaoh was threatened by the rapid increase in numbers of the Hebrew people, and he treated them very harshly, but the more that he did so, the faster they multiplied. So out of frustration and desperation, the Pharaoh told the midwives to kill any male child of the Hebrew people. Now, this was to keep them from developing a threatening fighting force of men. Now, when the midwives did not comply, the Pharaoh ordered every male child thrown into the river. Now, Moses was born and to the tribe of Levi, and he had been put into the river in a little vessel to where he could float, and he was found floating in the river by Pharaoh's daughter, fortunately, as God would have it, and he was raised as a son in the household of Pharaoh for the first 40 years of his life. And as you'll see, Moses' life could be divided into three 40-year periods. As we mentioned before, God blessed him especially to live the limit of the 120 years. But his life was indeed divided into three parts. I've just described the first part, of course, without the details. He's about to enter into the second third of his life. Moses spent the next 40 years of his life away from Egypt in a place called Midian, where he married. During this time, he had his first encounter with God. Now, he ended up going to Midian basically because when he turned 40, he started to think more about his own people, and he killed an Egyptian that was beating a Hebrew. And Pharaoh wanted him for murder, of course. That was one bad thing. And also the Jews, who he called himself to defending and becoming more at one with, they hated him for making their situation worse. And so he left and found himself in Midian. Now, as I mentioned before, he had his first encounter with God at this point, and this is when a burning bush served as the place from where God's voice spoke to Moses, and we all kind of know about that. Now, Moses was instructed by God via this burning bush to deliver God's people out of bondage in Egypt and reminded him about the promised land. Now, of course, Moses didn't think at all that he could pull this off. Of course, you know, Pharaoh was great and mighty. The Jewish people were not really happy with Moses at this point. How in the world was he going to pull this off? In addition to that, Moses had a speech impediment, probably stuttering. He certainly wasn't confident in his speech. And so God allowed Aaron, his brother, to be the actual spokesperson, although Moses was the leader. Moses' sister Miriam also was involved in helping him ultimately. So now God has sent Moses to deliver his people out of Egypt. So of course then he had to confront the Pharaoh. And there definitely was not any cooperation on the part of Pharaoh with these plans. He had no plans of releasing this cheap labor force that he had in the Hebrews. So he did not cooperate willingly, but after a series of plagues from God, he finally agreed to let the Hebrews go. Now the final straw was when the death angel came and killed all of the firstborn males at midnight. Now God had promised that to the Hebrew people that the angel would not kill the firstborn males of any house that had lamb's blood smeared on the doorpost. Thus, the creation of the Passover, the idea that the death angel would pass over any house with this blood on the doorpost. And so the Hebrews had a feast that night with the meat of the lambs that they had sacrificed for the blood to protect their firstborn. And they also had very little time to eat this night, and so they used no yeast or leaven in their bread cakes. And so this, along with bitter herbs and the Passover lamb, are the key features of the commemorating feast of Passover or unleavened bread. And so the Hebrews crossed the Red Sea, which had was parted by God to allow them to escape. They found themselves with the Egyptian army in front of them and the Red Sea behind them, and not knowing how in the world they were going to be delivered. And that's when Moses spoke the very famous words, "Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord." And this imagery is something that we all could use from time to time in our walks with God in this life, because there are times when you simply have to stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. You have a tough situation in front of you, an impossible situation behind you, and there are times when God simply has to deliver you according to His will, and you have to trust that. So in our lives, as I've said before, we all have had a Pharaoh's army, and we have all had Red Seas that we can look back on that God has parted for us. So once the Hebrew people began to walk into the Red Sea on dry land by God's awesome miracle, Pharaoh's army changed their minds and decided to pursue the Jewish people. Well, as God would have it, the army that was pursuing the Jewish people were swallowed up as God stopped holding back the walls of the water and allowed the water to crash in on the pursuing army, and they all drowned. This was their judgment for attempting to harm God's people after He had said, "Let His people go." So they could have chosen to simply let it be, but they just couldn't, and so they had to suffer. Now the rest of the book of Exodus consists of the travels of the Hebrew people in the desert, or the wilderness, some people would call it. They were led by a pillar of fire by night and a cloud by day. You might imagine that in addition to leading them, this pillar of fire would give them light at night and also would provide them warmth in the cold desert nights. And the cloud would also provide cooling from the hot sun by day. And they were supernaturally sustained by God by manna, which was a substance that they could make cakes from that they found in the morning like dew on the ground. And manna means, what is this? In other words, they called it that because they had no idea what it was. They just knew that God had it there for them to sustain them. And so one other thing that's interesting is that God told them to take just enough for that day and not to save any. And if they did, the manna would actually spoil and wouldn't do them any good. And also on the sixth day, prior to the Sabbath, they were not to go out on the seventh day to get any, that the what they would get on the sixth day would sustain them. And of course, they wouldn't stick with those rules either. And so this story replayed itself over and over in the history of the children of Israel. And so the Jews were sustained by the manna, as I mentioned, and also God did other miracles for the children of Israel, such as they ran into water that was bitter and they got frustrated, and God changed the bitter waters to sweet for them. They were thirsty at some point and were complaining again, and God brought water out of a rock for them. And so, unfortunately, they did spend a great deal of this time in the desert complaining about their conditions, even though God repeatedly performed miracles for them and had delivered them from an oppression that they claimed to want to be rid of. And so they were oftentimes, unfortunately, even wishing to be back in Egypt again. And so God got tired of them, being ungrateful. And he decided that only those under the age of 20 at the time, therefore those who essentially had been born outside of Egypt and were not longing to go back to Egypt, and the only these would make it into God's promised land of Canaan. And actually, if you recall, Joshua and Caleb from my message Uncovering God's Hidden Treasure, Joshua and Caleb were among these youngsters that would make it into the promised land. And so God caused them to wander for a total of 40 years, thus ensuring that all that were above 40 were dead by that time, when they reached the promised land of Canaan. And during this 40 years, now I didn't get into the details, but during this 40 years is when at the foot of Mount Sinai they received the Ten Commandments, and also other laws were given to them through Moses. Now, as for this 40-year span, there were definitely other events that occurred during this time. One of the events that's pretty well known is the golden calf worship that occurred on one of the occasions when Moses went on the mountain to speak to God and left Aaron behind, and Moses came back quite angry about the fact that his people, God's people, had created this golden calf to worship it. They also, at this time, one of the very important events is they commissioned and built a tabernacle, a place or for God to reside. Of course, not all of God, but a small representation of God. A tabernacle just means a tent. And so these were tent dwellers. And so they were nomadic people moving around in the desert. And so the point here was that, what about God? He He went before them with a pillar of fire and a cloud during the day. And what about God? God has no place to reside. And so they created a tent or a tabernacle for God, along with other implements for the worship of God and sacrifice to God. Again, this was a mobile structure which was necessary because of their way of life in the wilderness. And the tribe of Levi was designated to do the priestly duties, which involved the worship of God and this tabernacle. And of course, these duties were started by and led by Moses and Aaron, who were of the tribe of Levi. Now, you can take a look back at your handouts where we looked at the temple back in the book of Luke. Well, the temple was built on the same idea as a tabernacle. And if you look into the most holy place, that was to be the place where God would reside. And only one time per year would the high priest be able to go into this most holy place. And so in that most holy place you found the Ark of the Covenant. That Ark, of course, was a box. God designed it very specially. And within that box were three things. They were the manna, a jar of manna, which represented God's providing for the people and the miracle that occurred in the desert. The budding rod of Aaron, I'll have you read that in Exodus yourself, but that represented a miraculous situation as God brought them out of Egypt, or just before he brought them out of Egypt. And also the two stone tablets that God had written with his own finger, the Ten Commandments, for Moses to give to the people. So these things in the Ark or the Box of the Covenant were all sacred things that represented God's deliverance of his people. Now, just hovering on the top of the covenant, on top of the Ark, this place was called the Mercy Seat. And there was a Shekinah glory, or the cloud of God's glory, that resided there on top of the Ark of the Covenant. And to either side, there were images, golden images of cherubim, a certain type of angel, facing each other on the top of the Ark of the Covenant. Now, this Ark of the Covenant, or this box that carried these treasured items, was not to be touched. It represented such a holy representation of God that it was not to be touched even by the priests. They were the only ones that were to deal with the implements in all of the temple, but they could not touch the Ark of the Covenant. And so it was made, designed on God's specifications with golden rings, which gold rods were placed inside those rings. They would lift the Ark of the Covenant with these golden rods and carry it with the rods on their shoulders so that they did not come into direct physical contact with the Ark of the Covenant. Remember, we were now physically separated from God by the sin that occurred in the Garden of Eden. This is unfortunately what we ended up with. Now, one other thing that I'll mention that occurred while they were in the desert, you may recall this from back in Luke when Jesus chose 70 disciples to go out into the cities. This harkens back to an episode in the wilderness when Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, suggested to him that he was just overwhelmed trying to handle all of these people himself, and he was becoming frustrated, and so he suggested that he delegate his responsibilities to 70 elders. And so he did choose 70 elders of the leaders from each tribe, and this is also the design from which they got the Sanhedrin court. which was led by 70 men, ultimately being led by the high priest. So, folks, of course, I've left out a lot of details, but that essentially gives you an idea of the key events in the book of Exodus. And as you may already know, Moses angered God, and therefore he was not allowed, as much as he was able to live to the extent of human life at that time, he was not allowed to enter into the promised land. But he was blessed. He asked God to allow him to look over and at least see the promised land, and he was able to do that. So at this point, as far as the leadership of God's people, God had chosen Joshua to lead his people in Moses' stead, and Joshua was an assistant to Moses during all of this time. And so that's it, folks, for the book of Exodus. And we're going to talk a little bit. Well, let's go ahead and do it now. We'll just briefly touch on a few other books. The book of Leviticus contains in detail the laws of God given to the Hebrew people to govern themselves by. These laws were given during this 40 years that we spoke of, the latter 40 years of Moses' life. And this is the law that the Jewish leaders had distorted so much and added to and abused when Jesus came on the scene, as we read in the book of Luke. So feel free to take a look at Leviticus and learn about those laws. You'll also notice that God took quite a bit of effort to focus on many of the situations in life, and his intent was to make sure that everybody was taken care of. And a lot of these rules and laws had to do with if they followed it, if they could avoid illness, they could minimize the spread of illness when it occurred. It really was a set of laws to govern the people with God's wisdom. They didn't have to always know why. The point is that God told them to do these things, just like back in the Garden of Eden with the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. God understood why. Their job was simply to obey. So, you know, even in armed conflict in this day and age and all throughout history, you have had foot soldiers that have had to follow orders, not always understanding the big picture. If we can do it in a war, we should certainly be able to do it for God. And so next, the book of Numbers depicts much of the detail of the Hebrews wandering in the desert for the 40 years. And so if you have a chance to read the book of Numbers, you will see a lot more of the detail that you don't see in the book of Exodus. So the book of Numbers is a good way to go through and see all of these details of the wandering of the children of Israel in the desert. And then the book of Deuteronomy is essentially a restatement of the law by Moses himself before he died. Its name is based on the idea that it was sort of a second law. It was Moses' last chance to make clear what he as a leader was intending to get across to God's people on God's behalf. Well, that's it for the Pentateuch, or the Torah, the writings are written by the most noted prophet in all of Hebrew history, most likely. That would be Moses. And so we're going to move on from here, and on your next CD, we're going to pick up with the book of Joshua, and then we'll move on to Judges, etc. So that's it for your first CD in our series on an overview of the Old Testament, and I'll see you on CD number 2.